Goodness. Thank you so very much. I'm glad to be here, this part of Los Angeles. I must confess, this is my first visit after living here for 35 years, to Artesia. I don't think I've ever been to this little part of it at all. Good to see so many of you representing so many different denominations and groups. And it's always a privilege for me to speak to Christian leaders. I think I have given most of my life to pastors, most of my professional life. Many of you, or some of you at least, know I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been at Fuller Seminary for 35 years. In fact, it's really 37 years because I came a year in 71 as a postdoc to be at Fuller. Then served as dean of the School of Psychology for a while and then went back to being a full-time professor. And for the last 5 years, I have enjoyed what is just a little short of heaven. It's called retirement. The only problem is that my brain hasn't quite gotten the idea of what retirement is about, because I must apologize. I can't stay with you the whole morning. I have to leave a little bit before lunch because I have to teach this afternoon and this evening, and I finish around 9:30 this evening, so it's going to be a long day for me, and that's what they call retirement. I thank you to the worship team for setting the stage for us. I have one comment, though, and you had one too many nahs before the hey. There was clearly only five on the screen, and you sang six. So I don't know what effect that has on God's heart, you know, whether that worship really does get to him. But thank you for that. And I'm always intrigued at the glass cages around the drums. Reminds me of my eldest grandson when he was about 16. 16 is the age teenagers know everything. I mean, there's nothing you can teach them, you know. And he and I had gone to a Saturday night youth service. And it's orchestra, you know, band and all the rest of it. And while we were standing there singing, I nudged Vincent. He's tall, he's 6'3". And I nudged and I said, "Hey, Vincent, why do you think that guy has a glass cage around the drums?" And he looked down at me and then he leant over and he said, "Well, Papa, it's like this." And I get this lecture about sound, how you can see through it, Papa, but the sound actually bounces off it, you know. And he's going on in this lecture about sound waves and what that glass cage does. I said, "Oh, Vincent, no, you got it all wrong. You got it all wrong. Bulletproof glass." But he burst out laughing. Everybody turned around. Bulletproof glass. But thank you, worship team. As Rick mentioned, I want to address a topic that is very, very close to my heart. I've done 25, I'm working on my 26th book now, and some of them I think have been important. My Adrenaline and Stress book continues after almost 24 years to be a pretty good seller, and if I go anywhere in the world, I'm usually known because of my book, Adrenaline and Stress. It was a significant book. I wrote it at a time when, although science had made the connection between our adrenaline and our adrenaline excitement and stress, it had not been generally accepted. So the idea that adrenaline is linked to stress was a very powerful concept. And of course, today, that's how everybody thinks about stress. But this last book I've just written, Thrilled to Death, and Rick knows that one condition only that I would be willing to do an extra teaching session today would be that I could speak about this topic. And I want to speak about not because I want to promote my book. Listen, don't bother to buy that book, okay? Don't worry about that. That's not my reason for being here. Thank you. My reason for being here is that this is probably the most important development in our day and age that we as Christian leaders cannot ignore. Or if we do, we ignore it to our peril. carol. There is something going on in all our brains at the moment that you as a Christian leader need to know about. So I apologize. I'm going to have a few technical phrases. I'll try and make it as easy on you as possible. But there are a few new, you need to learn a few new things today. Ignorance is Satan's greatest weapon. Ignorance is Satan's greatest weapon. I'm deeply embedded in theology as a psychologist. I value a doctrine of creation. I don't know how you can be a Christian leader unless you've sorted out your doctrine of creation. God has created me, this wonderful body, and put in my head a wonderful brain. A brain so powerful, so phenomenal, that listen to this. A guy by the name of Owen Gingrich, astrophysicist at Harvard University, top astrophysicist. They are the guys who study the massive universe around us. Is a Christian. He's written a wonderful book, God and the Universe. And I was stunned a couple of months ago when I was reading that book. He made this comment, and I want to use it as a sort of a springboard today. He made this comment. Of all this massive universe, traveling at the speed of light, you will have to travel millions and millions and millions of miles at the speed of light to get anywhere near the end of it. And even when you've traveled that distance, you probably are still nowhere near the end of this universe. That massive universe, only we as humans have the capacity to know that, to know the enormousness of this universe. And with that, he counters the typical scientific mentality, and that is humans are just another accident. That we are, in the great cosmos things, we are insignificant. No, he says. We, next to God, are the only ones who can know this universe. I have never quite gotten over that idea of how enormously powerful our brain is. And he has given us a brain, and he has designed it in a certain way, and then, and this is the theological kicker, then says to you and to me, live within the boundary of my design. We have a wonderful brain, but it is by design limited. I call it a box. Fits in a box. It's just a box. The outside of the box represents the boundaries, the limits. One of my students, John Ortberg, wrote a great book called It All Goes Back in the Box. Great idea, you know, everything you accomplish, everything you achieve in your life, one day, all goes back in that box with you. And we bury it 6 feet down. It's a great idea, but that's not how I use the box. Created us with this phenomenal brain, but there are limits. And those limits come clearly specified. Two portions of scripture I want to use to kick off what I want to talk about. First, in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7. It starts chapter 4 with these words, therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. And then in verse 7 he says, but we have this treasure in jars of clay. Jars of clay. Limits. Limits. Live inside the box and you accomplish God's great plan for all this massive universe. Live outside it, you pay the penalty. And I have been around long enough to know that of all the professional groups I know, pastors, Christian leaders, pay a greater penalty than anyone else. Because somehow we think stupidly. I'm old enough now to call you stupid, okay? We think that somehow, because we do God's work, we have a permit to live outside the box. You don't. You don't. It says a lot about sleep. My book I'm working on right now is a book on sleep. It says a lot about rest. It says a lot about Sabbath. It says a lot about just how far we can push the human frame before it starts to break down. Now, let me tell you this. As a clinical psychologist, board certified in psychopharmacology, I know my field. Never in history has the human mind been so eroded, is being so broken down as it is now. I've written a whole bunch of books on depression. Ten years ago, do you know what the incidence of depression was? If you have an audience like this gathered together, I remember speaking to one denominational world conference in Toronto, and there were 7,500 pastors and spouses at that, and I was talking to them about the incidence of depression. I said, we've got 7,500 people here. There are 750 of you who are clinically depressed. 10% of any gathering of people are clinically depressed. Only a third of it know it or get treatment for it. That was 10 years ago. Now, when I speak to a gathering of people, do you know what I say? Probably one in five. Teenagers, clinical depression in teenagers running now one in four. I am predicting that within the next 10 years, every teenager will have to be on an antidepressant, if only to protect their brains from the damage caused by what's going on in their world and the damage that causes depression. If depression is untreated, the brain is what we call neural plasticity. The brain grows connections to entrench the depression. It's as simple as that. It's how the box is designed. But today, specifically, I want to address what is now in neuroscience circles becoming a great, great concern. And that is what we are doing to the brain's pleasure system. The technical phrase, word, you might as well make a note of it, practice it, turn it into a mantra. When you go to sleep, just say it over and over again just to get it in your mind. The technical word is anhedonia. A-N-H-E-D-O-N-I-A. Anhedonia. That's what I'm going to be talking about today. Anhedonia. Hedonism, hedon, pleasure. Put an in front of it and you have no pleasure. Anhedonia. Now, epidemic. Now, the primary reason driving sexual addictions. Anhedonia. It's all about the damage we're doing to our pleasures. And as Christian leaders, you contribute unwittingly to that damage if you don't understand the phenomenon. That's it. Giving you my speech. My wife says, when you know, most people only listen to one sentence. Everything you say, they only take one sentence. So just tell them what it is at the beginning, and then they can go back to sleep if they want to. But the second portion of Scripture. So my first theological comment is this: God has designed us with limits, a box, and we have to live inside that box. Then 2 Timothy chapter 3. I'm not one great on eschatology and so on. I'm not great on that, but I was struck when some little while ago I was reading Paul's second letter to Timothy, and chapter 3 says these words. But mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited. Listen to this one. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And that sort of fits my thesis, what I would like to share with you. We will break in at about, say, 10:45. Gives me about another 45 minutes. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come together. And I want to take what I'm going to share with you about how we are destroying our brain's pleasure system. And I want to apply it to two areas in the lives of Christian leaders. The first area, sexual addictions. Christianity Today, the very latest edition, has a whole feature article on the incidence of inappropriate sexual behavior on the part of Christian leaders. I've been preaching that for 35 years. Finally, we're waking up to some of this. But you need to know how, if you mess with your brain's pleasure system, you set yourself up for addictions of all sorts. Behaviors, not just substances, but behaviors. And in the case mainly of men, sexual issues. And then the second application will be, if we have time, to the whole stress burnout phenomenon in Christian leadership. Those will be my two areas of application. I have some of my CDs at the back. I have a CD on this whole pleasure lost idea. It's a presentation I made to a large group of pastors' wives, but it's a fairly clear, articulate presentation, and that is also available. Anhedonia is on the march. Now epidemic. It used to be the primary symptom in schizophrenia and clinical depression. First thing you look for when you have a patient who's depressed, you look for anhedonia. Because in schizophrenia and in clinical depression, the pathways to the pleasure system, the pleasure center, and there is a center in the brain. I'm going to describe it a little bit more accurately in a moment. In the brain, to which from other parts of the brain, messages are sent saying, enjoy, enjoy. And these pathways to the brain in clinical depression are blocked. They are blocked because the primary neurotransmitter, the chemical messenger in the brain that services the pleasure system, it's just a small little localized part of the brain, but the chemical messenger that services that part of the brain is called dopamine. D-O-P-A-M-I-N-E. Write it down, because you're going to hear a lot about this stuff. You're going to hear a lot about it. Dopamine. And what happens in depression is one of the three primary chemical messengers, dopamine, shuts down. So with low dopamine, no pleasure signals can reach that important part of the brain. And when you have no pleasurable feelings at all, when nothing in life can give you no longer any pleasure, what do? You go and blow your brains out. Been involved in a spate of recent suicides. One of my patients, best friend, wonderful Christian guy, and this is what always blows my mind. You know, a wonderful Christian man, beautiful family, three beautiful children, paid a visit to him in Los Angeles, And while they were all together as a family, just excused himself and went out in the backyard and shot himself. Doesn't he realize that his kids are going to come out and find their daddy lying on the ground with blood all over them? No, you don't. This is depression. Depression is a serious phenomenon. And it shuts down. So we look for it in depression. And in schizophrenia, same thing. In schizophrenia, it's excessive dopamine. What happens is you get flooding of that system and it cannot work at all. I got into this area of anhedonia about 10, 12 years ago when I was asked by the Veterans Administration Hospital to help, this is in Sepulveda, to help them figure out a way to determine whether a cocaine addict was in recovery. They have a lot of young people, cocaine addicts, children of veterans, being treated in the veterans' hospitals. And you hospitalize them usually for about 6 months and they start the treatment. And then finally you release them at the end of 6 months and the very next day they're back into their cocaine habit again. Is there any way we can tell so we know early whether it's working or not? That was the challenge. And it was a research project I worked on for a while and we did come up with a way. We were able to figure out a way. And it all centered on the pleasure system. And just to short-circuit that, we can tell when a cocaine addict in recovery is actually recovering by testing whether or not a little bit of pleasure is coming back into their system. Because what cocaine does, cocaine hijacks the pleasure system. Cocaine takes total control of it. Nothing but cocaine in a cocaine addict can give pleasure. It's the most powerful drug there is for the pleasure system. It goes direct to this part of the brain. It's very powerful. And always, when you stop taking cocaine, in the 6 months of recovery, we need to see some pleasure in other little things starting to come back online. I devised a system of slides where we can show pictures and measure facial expressions and tell this person's recovering, that person's not. This person's pleasure system is going nowhere. So that's what is behind it. There are several things that can cause anhedonia. Anything that gives you pleasure has the potential to become addicting. I wrote a book 15 years ago called Healing Life's Hidden Addictions because I was pretty convinced that we are addicted not just to substances, but also to habits, behaviors. Gambling, jogging, sex. But when I wrote the book, believe it or not, there was a huge debate raging. All the addiction specialists were insisting it had to have a substance, else it cannot be addicting. And in my book, I make the case. It is a substance. When I'm addicted to jogging, you know why I jog and jog and jog and jog and jog? It's because I'm looking for an endorphin rush. Why do I become a workaholic? Because I want an adrenaline rush. I become addicted to my adrenaline. So in the final analysis, the behaviors that we become addicted to are actually part of the brain's functions anyway, and its chemistry and so on. But the pleasure system in order to give you pleasure has to be able to get unimpeded signals from various parts of the brain. About 6 months ago, I was in Europe teaching in Switzerland. And at the end of my teaching, I was working on my book, Thrill to Death. I had planned an extra 3 days, and I was going to take a train over to the other side, to Lake Thun, it's called, a little place called Einigen, that I love. It's a little tiny village overlooking Lake Thun, beautiful, right up with all the farms and the cows and their jingling bells. And there's a little Christian retreat center there, and I just love it. And so does all my family. I've had taken my grandchildren there with me and my daughters. We just love Einigen. And how I was finished my teaching a Friday afternoon. I got on the train. I'm going to take the train over past Zell and so on down to Lake Thun and go and spend 2-3 days in Einigen and just sit back and relax. Enjoy the Swiss countryside and the bells of the cowbells and get some writing done. But when I got on the train and sat back, I was expecting to feel joyful. I felt no joy, no pleasure. That train ride was the longest, most miserable train ride. Usually as you climb out, you catch the connection at Lausanne, and as you go up into the mountains, you start to climb up and up and get this gorgeous view down across Lake Geneva. And I sat there and I said, so what? So what? Arrived on the other side, they came and fetched me, took me to Einigen. I had a little room. It's a 600-year-old mansion. I have a nice little room upstairs, private balcony overlooking Jungfrau, overlooking wonderful parts of Switzerland. And I love Switzerland. And I sat there and I yawned and I went in. Had no interest. Didn't feel a thing. What's that called? Anhedonia. What happens is that in the process of stimulating the pleasure system, if you keep that pleasure going, if you keep that excitement going, the pathways, the dopamine pathways, become flooded. And you can no longer get any more pleasure. That is anhedonia. Discovered in 1954, with experiments on a rat, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to show the video in a moment. Is it okay? We'll try it in a moment. But let me just set the background. I'm going to show you a short video because to drive home this point, it'll be interesting for you to see how this was discovered. But some researchers in the early 50s were looking at the brain. They had discovered a center in the brain for rage, anger. And they implanted electrodes in a rat's head into the rage center, and they brought the wires out and then connected it to a generator that generates little pulses, electrical pulses. And they found if they push the button, the rat goes into a rage, and you stop the button, and the rat is as calm as anything. And they were experimenting with the rage center. But one day, the technician who was implanting these electrodes missed the rage center by a fraction of a millimeter. And the electrode went into an organ right next to it. And when they pushed the button, this rat looked ecstatic. Like he was having a fantastic orgasm. It was just phenomenal. And they were taken by surprise. So what they did was they connected the button to a lever so the rat could press the button itself. Anhedonia.
The rat continuously pressed a lever, switching on a tiny electric current. Neglecting food and water, the rat worked relentlessly in favor of one thing only, its brain stimulation. When humans undergoing neurosurgery receive stimulation in the same region of the brain, They describe feelings of intense pleasure and elation. This area of the brain became known as the pleasure center. The pleasure center, like the fear center, drives animal behavior. But instead of handling emergencies, it can be stimulated by food, exercise, sex, maybe even herding sheep. The brain produces specific chemicals like dopamine to drive the pleasure system. As this dog herds his sheep, there's a rush of dopamine to the pleasure center of his brain. He probably enjoys that. The sheep may not get much dopamine out of being herded, but pleasure matters to sheep, too. At the Babraham Institute, Dr. Kendrick is running a dating service in his lab. Female sheep are shown photos of potential companions. One sheep may look the same as another to us, but Kendrick has discovered that sheep are very particular about whom they want to be with, and they choose on the basis of looks. A female sheep who is not in season always chooses another female from her own flock. But number 14 is in season, and she chooses very differently. She fancies a ram. This is not cold-blooded calculation, nor is she picking at random. Kendrick has found that the mere sight of the ram that she likes activates the pleasure centers of her brain. In season and out, it's the dopamine that drives the ewe's decision. We have to assume that she genuinely likes what she's seen and feels happy.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's the pleasure system in the brain. Just one more thought before I get into how we are messing with it. Why do you think God put in us a pleasure center? Well, I think I'm pretty clear on that issue. God has put in us the ability to take joy in Him. We say that in the catechism. Most catechisms will have something like that. It is without that system, you can have no joy in God. It's impossible. It is necessary for Christian believers. This is why people in deep clinical depression feel distant from God. They can make no connection with God. They have nothing but profound feelings of it's not just despondency, it's not just sadness. Sadness is the least important thing we look for in depression. We look for this lack of ability to experience pleasure. This system that carries pleasure signals to the pleasure part of the brain can be hijacked by a number of things. It can be hijacked by drugs. Anything that is addicting solely because it takes control of the pathway to the pleasure center. So therefore, it is a major factor in the development of all addictions. Now, why should we as Christian leaders be concerned about this? Well, for several reasons. Reason number one is that this whole phenomenon is opening up a whole new set of pathologies. There is now a form of depression that is called non-sadness depression. It's identified by what is missing. It's non-sadness depression. Its only symptom is this profound loss of ability to experience pleasure. And there's a very, very high incidence. It is also a problem that drives addictions, behavior addictions. And this is why I feel that probably our children or grandchildren are going to be the ones who will pay the price here. They will be the ones who will pay the price here. There is an enormously risk in our young people of developing anhedonia because of changing lifestyles. Dennis Prager, who is, I hope, known to most of you at any rate, a radio talk show host who has been very reconciliatory towards Christians, evangelical Christians. But he wrote an article recently which is entitled, "Excitement is a Dangerous Drug." And I was very impressed because he identifies absolutely accurately what neuroscience is now concerned about and how we are messing with the brain's pleasure system and the effect it is having on our young people today. He writes, "When we give our child a present, he experiences excitement, and we are delighted when we see how happy he is. When done occasionally on a holiday or a birthday, this is perfectly fine. But children should have those special moments and remember them forever. Today's young people have the ability to experience excitement more than any other generation before. Outside of school, excitement is available almost 24/7. But all this excitement is actually inhibiting our children's ability to enjoy life and therefore be happy. The most common expression I hear in my grandchildren is, 'I'm bored. I'm bored.' Now, I was bored a lot when I was a kid. I grew up in South Africa. There was no television in my day. Radio was almost all classical music. There were no commercial radio stations. I hardly ever listened to a radio. School time was the most boring, school holiday time was the most boring time of my life. But in retrospect, what I discovered was that my boredom as a child, which is different, my grandchildren's boredom is because they are overstimulated. They have too much excitement in their lives. They have cell phones. Our two granddaughters, they have two cell phones each because you've got two ears. So why can't you talk to two friends at the same time? They have iPods. They are constantly bombarded with excitement and stimulation. And they cannot stand boredom. They cannot stand silence. You get in the car, the first thing you've got to do is turn the radio on. But their boredom is because of anhedonia. The flooding of their pleasure system is in slowly destroying their ability to take pleasure in the little things of life. When I was bored as a child, it did two things for me. The first thing it did, it created in me a vivid imagination. I grew up during the Second World War. There were no toys. You made toys out of bits of tomato box wood. I did get myself a penknife. And a lot of trees we had nice thick bark. I could take bark off a tree. I could carve things with it. I learned to carve with a penknife, as did all my buddies. We turned mundane things into vivid, exciting toys. I remember making my first gun to play cowboys and crooks, because we did watch American movies occasionally. And And, you know, with a few pieces of wood, pen knife to carve something, and some black shoe polish, polish it up. And those toys were treasured. When I give my kids, when they were small, or my grandchildren now, a toy at Christmas time, how long do you think it holds their attention? 20 seconds? It's a perfect replica of some fancy gadget. Whereas mine, you know, anyone looking at it would not know what it was in my imagination, but I fostered in me a tremendous imagination that I value today. The second thing was, it was creativity. We had to create our pleasure and excitement. I grew up in a gold mining area of South Africa. There's a huge mine dump there. And it was a mountain. Because it was flat country, there were no mountains. It became a mountain. It had a lot of rock on it. We could go up there. We could build castles. We built castles. Castles on this side, castles on that side. And we had battles, knights fighting each other. My grandchildren haven't the slightest idea what this is all about. And so what is happening in our culture is we are losing our imaginations and we are losing our creativity. Most people want pleasure dished up on a plate, all spelled out neat and tidy. Now, what has this got to do with our Christian life? As a pastor, as a Christian leader, I think it is vitally important for you to be aware of the phenomenon of anhedonia and how you might be contributing to it in some way, first of all. And secondly, surely our gospel has to be a safe haven from anhedonia. Thirdly, if you're not careful, you can provide so much excitement in worship, in spiritual practices, that you slowly shut down the ability to really take joy out of their spiritual experience, take joy out of God. One of the issues I address in my book is how the pleasure system is related to our ability to be happy. Now, the whole field of happiness is a fascinating one. I wrote a book on happiness 17 years ago. It's called 15 Principles for Achieving Happiness. I wrote it because psychologists were poo-pooing the whole idea. Psychologists didn't talk about happiness. You will not find a single reference to happiness in any psychology textbook older than 5 years. We rediscovered it about 8 years ago. Psychology rediscovered happiness. Today, it is big business. Today, some of the most prestigious universities in this country are teaching psychologists something about happiness, how to help people experience it. Because that's part of the box. It's part of the box. But what is happening is that with our overloading the stimulation of our kids, and I mean, just think for a moment, all that they have available to them in terms of DVDs, MP3s, MP4s, and I know some of you don't even know what I'm talking about. iPods, iPhones, NASCAR, reality shows, water parks, theme and thrill parks, MTV, computer games. Oh, but I blow my stack a few weeks ago in class, in both the classes I teach. I teach psychopharmacology, and then I teach psychological testing. I blew my stack. Because students were coming to class, and we have wireless internet in the classrooms. I don't know why. I'm going to get hold of our president and wring his neck for allowing it. But in the classroom, we have wireless internet. And students sit towards the back with their laptops. And you know what they're doing while I am lecturing? The internet surfing, playing games against each other. And you see them giggling and laughing at the back. And I haven't made a joke. I just blew my stack. Right on the board. The next person that connects with the internet in this classroom will be dismissed from the class. And I've been getting these scowls ever since, you know. Now, there's two guys particularly in this one class. Today is the last class for the quarter, so I'm glad to be done with them. But they can't shut it down. They have constant access to some form of excitement. And this has a very, very detrimental effect. We're like nomads on a treadmill. In fact, it's been called the hedonic treadmill. And if we're not careful, and I mean this seriously, in order to compete with the world, in order to get people to come to church, in order to get our young people, you know, captive and so on like that, we can very easily go a little too far in offering stimulating excitement and in the process be adding to the anhedonia that one day is going to be very serious damage for them. There's another important aspect to all of this that I want to mention as well. And it comes from the multitasking phenomenon in our culture today. Multitasking. I went over one day to my oldest daughter's home, Catherine. She's written some books with me. And my youngest granddaughter by Catherine is Caitlin. Lovely little girl. Now 14. And I walked into to the house, down into the living room area, and there Caitlin was sitting with a laptop on her lap, which is where laptops go, and she was doing her homework. I paused there for a moment because I noticed she was also watching the television. We have a large television screen there, and she was watching the television. She was doing her homework. As I got nearer her, I noticed that her screen was split in two. On the left side of the screen, she's writing an essay. On the right side of the screen, she's doing this blogging thing with someone. In the left ear, she had her iPod playing music. And in the right ear, she had her cell phone earpiece. She was listening to music, talking to a friend on the cell phone, blogging with someone else on that side, watching television, and trying to do her homework. So I walked up to her and said, "Caitlin, do you really think you can do all these things at the same time and expect to learn anything?" Oh, she looked up at me. "Oh, Papa," she said, "you don't know about these things." She said, "If I don't do these other things, I can't do my homework." And she's right. She's right. She has to be talking to a friend. Because she cannot just focus on one task anymore. She is so accustomed to multitasking that unless she has multiple stimulant inputs, her brain goes berserk. She can't tolerate silence or focusing on one task. Now, it just so happened the day I went over and saw her do this was the day that Time magazine had published as its front cover article. And almost the whole of its edition was focused on the threat that multitasking has in the lives of our young people today. And just research after research shows that when you multitask, what you are doing is something called toggling. Toggling. You toggle in this and you toggle in that. You're jumping backwards and forwards. And the brain is totally confused. Does not make the connections necessary to good learning. They do it because it feels good. Okay, now I want to talk about some solutions. And in doing so, and then we'll take a break, and after the break, we'll have some discussion. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how this impacts our stress and how it impacts our addictions, our potential for addictions in the Christian world. Because there is a rapidly growing increase in addictions within our Christian subculture. A rapidly growing. Because if you can't get pleasure out of the little things in your life, then you turn to the big things. It's as simple as that. Now, my book, of course, I have a whole second half of the section devoted to some of the solution issues. But I want to focus here, because it's just a brief time I have, in talking to you about the two types of pleasure. I think it can be very helpful. Because trust me, I am a gadget man. I got the iPods. I got portable DVDs, players, and I've got, if there's a gadget out in this world, I'll be the first to get it. My grandkids often say that I'm usually 10 steps ahead of them. You know, they come in, they're excited about some new gadget. I've been there, done that, kid. You know, I am very, very prone. Because of my creativity and my imagination, I can get into all sorts of stimulating and exciting projects. I've got a project going right now. I'm designing some equipment, some instruments for monitoring stress levels. And I do all my own programming, and I design and build all my own electronics. I got so many exciting things to do. There just isn't enough time in the day for me to do it. So this issue has been very important for me personally to address. And it's been very helpful as I've thought about this to divide pleasure into two categories, two types of pleasure. Just as we have two types of people, basically, type A people and type B people. Type A people, always in a hurry, very time conscious. Finish your sentences for you because you're just too slow. They're the ones who stand in line somewhere, and you see them tapping their foot like this, and they're impatient. You know, type A people, me, classic type A. Then there are type B people. They're slow, sluggish, I think, but you know, slow to anger, never in a hurry. That's my wife, because something weird happens, because type A's always seem to marry type B's, and you know. But at any rate, just as we have those differences, I think that all pleasures divide into two categories. And this can be very helpful, because it's not that we take away the exciting, stimulating pleasures of life. That's not what. But that it has to be balanced by the other, I call type B pleasures. So life offers these type A pleasures, excitement, thrills, and it's full of it. But we have to, and particularly in our young people, we have to get them to understand and appreciate the value of some of the other types of pleasure that can balance the two and create a more balanced lifestyle. And when it comes to the issue of happiness, in fact, let me just backtrack for one moment. I forgot to mention this. In my book, I make a connection between the pleasure system and happiness. There is no center in the brain for happiness. There is no place where you can go and implant a couple of electrodes and say, well, here's the button. Whenever you want to be happy, just press that button. It doesn't work. Happiness involves the whole brain. The feeling of happiness comes from the whole brain. There is no part of the brain. But pleasure, that center called the locus accumbens, that's the name of the pleasure center, that pleasure center must be working properly. It has to be capable of receiving messages. When you look at a sunset, you should have a pleasurable feeling. My grandkids look at a sunset, they don't know what I'm talking about. They have no idea. But to be, if your pleasure system is not giving you the ability to appreciate something as pleasurable, there's no way your brain can deliver any sort of happiness to you. And there's a whole school in psychology now called the positive psychology movement that is into things like authentic happiness, enduring happiness, And everything about happiness depends on a healthy pleasure system. That's the point of my book. If you abuse your pleasure system, if you are addicted to cocaine, trust me, there is no such thing as happiness in your life. Because your pleasure system is not okay. If you need the pleasure system to appreciate something to make you happy. That's as simple as that. Well, now the type A and type B pleasures. Type A pleasures, first of all. These are the over-the-top experiences. They usually follow the path of urgency, immediacy, heightened arousal. You feel the adrenaline surge. It feeds the adrenaline-hungry person, these sorts of pleasures, type A's. Type A pleasure relies on high excitement, thrills. It wants a wow experience. You go to church on a Sunday morning, and you sit there, and you say, "Give me a wow experience." Because you get wow all week. The last thing you want in church is a downer. You lose your capacity. You can't tolerate leisure. It wants something. By and large, it's the type of pleasure that our culture, our media offers people. By and large. The media thrives, makes their billions and billions out of offering us the thrilling, exciting type A pleasures. Now, in contrast to that, type B pleasures don't cost anything. The type A pleasure results in dopamine overdrive. Type B pleasure offers relaxation to the dopamine system. And I can summarize this very, very easily. Type B pleasures come from the natural things of life, and as in nature. Type B pleasure, when dad, who has been ignoring his two sons, always because he's always caught up in his own exciting, he's got his sales projects he's working on. And when he goes into the living room, he says to his two sons, "You know what? Guess what? Let's just turn off that television. I want you both to come with me. I want to take you for a hike. I want to take you to the park. I want to go and throw ball with you. I want to play with you. I want to be with you." Have you any idea how much kids crave that today? There was a study just recently that stated in no uncertain terms that what teenagers want more than anything else today is time with their kids, their parents, time with dad. Sure, they push you away. Sure, that you get the message that they want to reject you. I'm close enough to my own 9 grandchildren. I pretty well know what's going on in that world because they tell me. They wouldn't tell their folks, but they tell me. And they are craving that time together. My one granddaughter said to me the other day, when dad came in and said, "You know what, I'm going to go to the gym and work out. Would you like to come with me?" To one of his daughters. She was thrilled, absolutely thrilled. So it comes from natural experiences. It comes from relational experiences. It comes from anything that provides pleasure, but at the same time does so in actually lowering the stimulation level. Type B pleasures. I don't know when last we as a family packed a picnic basket, went up into the mountains somewhere just to have a picnic as a family. And I often ask families these days whether they do that anymore. I've yet to find a family that does that. Type B pleasures are the pleasures that come from relationship, come from doing things that get us closer to nature, get us out in the open, get us exercising, and provide a sort of a balanced way of looking at life. Anhedonia develops, and then I'd like you to comments and questions. I've had very good comments and questions during the break. If you'll just come to one of the two microphones here so everyone can hear it, and then I'll pick up from that on what I want to say about stress and addictions. In the system, the pleasure system, technical word is locus accumbens. Locus means it's located in one place. It's also known as the reward center because the pleasure system in the brain is designed to reward you with pleasure when you do certain things, hopefully the right things. As you begin to overstimulate the system, technically what happens is the dopamine now is being flooded. And there are zillions of nerve cells on the way to the pleasure center, and each one of them holds a certain amount of dopamine, and the level starts to go up. As the dopamine goes up, the best analogy I can give is that a barrier begins to build. On the road to the pleasure system, just imagine someone's building a brick wall. At first it's very free-flowing. You get pleasure out of simple, ordinary things. Someone just says hello, and oh, that just feels so good. You see a beautiful sunset. As a kid, I remember looking at clouds. My imagination, I could vividly create stories out of the clouds. My grandkids pay no attention to clouds. None. But so that system is free-flowing. But as you begin to overstimulate it, this brick wall begins to build. Someone lays a few layers of bricks. Now what's happened is that the next pleasure has to be a little bit more pleasurable than the previous pleasure. The wow has to out-wow the previous one. That's what all addictions do, right? You have to, at this level of drug, no, it's not enough now, you've got to up it. And that's true in behavior addictions also. And so we now have to provide a little more stimulating in order to get over the... But as the brick wall climbs and climbs, it becomes more demanding that it has to be an even higher fix to get a message to the pleasure system. And this phenomenon of the barrier building is what addictions are all about. And cocaine has... builds the most powerful barrier to everything. There's nothing else that can give pleasure. Only cocaine has the ability to climb that wall and get on the other side and carry that message to the pleasure system. And recovery is all about bringing that wall down again. And I explained that in the Veterans Administration Hospital Recovery Program, what we are looking for in a cocaine addict is some evidence that pleasure is coming back. And the interesting thing, the first sign we see, we use electrodes to measure the smile reflex. Because believe it or not, when you get pleasure, you actually smile. You actually smile. And we show them pictures, of cocaine paraphernalia. And a cocaine addict who is not in recovery has no smile reflex to a picture of cocaine. It has got to be cocaine itself. But if they can experience some pleasure into a picture of something related to cocaine and give us a smile reflex, we know that that barrier is starting to come down. Now, I think the big challenge for Christian leaders is how do we prevent contributing to that barrier? Our culture is doing it all the time. The media to which our kids are exposed, and our young people and young adults, and ourselves are being exposed to. The stress level is so high in most of our lives. We all have more to do than anyone has had to do in history before. And all of that is contributing to this phenomenon of anhedonia. And I'd be very interested in hearing from you as to what are some of the things we can do in our Christian subculture. One last comment before I invite you to come to the microphone. It is my opinion that modern-day spirituality has become stimulation-driven. That the practice of spirituality today is usually done with high levels of stimulation. And I give one example of my eldest grandson. He's a wonderful Christian young man, but he cannot pray unless he has his iPod playing some Christian music at the same time. The silence is scary for him. And I've been talking to him, you know, about that, how unfortunate that is. If you have to have something stimulating in order to be able to pray to God, experience God, it's this anhedonia stuff that's getting in the way. We are seeing in certain denominations a return to more contemplative reflection type spirituality. Seeing a return to when I was a young Christian, became a Christian at age 17, what was a strong part of my spirituality was something we called a quiet time that we had every morning. It was expected of me. And my buddies would hold me accountable. Did you have your quiet time this morning? If I was ratty and irritable, the first thing I'd say, did you have a quiet time? That's why you're angry and upset, because you didn't have a quiet time this morning. My 9 grandchildren, not one of them even know, and they're all Christians, what I mean by a quiet time, because their youth culture is not fostering it anymore. And if we're not careful, we will end up worshiping adrenaline rather than worshiping God. And that's where this could all lead. Okay, comments and questions. We don't have a lot of time, but please would you come and pose your... Could you come to the microphone? Any points of clarification or anything you would like me to expand on?
Hi. Thanks for what you shared. Very, very encouraging and enlightening. I guess one or two part questions. One is, many of us here, we don't really want to contribute to it, but maybe many of us here suffer from this, obviously, in ministry. It's part of the rush and the excitement. And maybe it's in your book, but other than try to force ourselves into this type B, is there other things you would encourage us to do? The reason why I ask is, you know, 7 years ago, my life crashed and burned. I had an affair. I was leading a church. You know, everything tanked. And I was looking for the rush and the rush and the rush of ministry. Yeah. And if somebody, and that could be somebody else here today.
Yeah.
And right. And I ended up at the Amen Clinic, brain scan, anxiety, depression, OCD.
The full works.
Yeah, and meds and recovery have changed my life.
Yeah. Yeah, tell me, say something about what changed your life. What would you find helpful? That would be...
Well, I mean, if I could, I'd write a check to get everybody here, if they were willing, a brain scan. I'd have them read Change Your Brain, Change Your Life by Dr. Daniel Amen. But it's sort of like, I for the last 7 years, I've committed my life to work with people. Yeah. My wife and I, although it's painful, we still go around and tell our stories. But what my hope, the only reason why we do it is we keep hoping we can prevent people from jumping off the cliff.
Sure.
But my fear and my experience even this past week has been, I can't do much until they hit bottom. Mm-hmm. And I understand that, because 7 years ago, if I had heard you and thought, man, this is good stuff, I got to get this to people in my congregation, mm-hmm. I would have missed me and said, oh, he says enjoy a sunset. I would have went out, tried to enjoy a sunset for about 2 minutes, and went back to the rush of what's the next program I'm doing, what's the next thing we're dreaming about, how can we start another campus, how can we switch this, mm-hmm. and how can we create experience, because we had such a powerful experience Sunday last week. We got to top it this week, otherwise they'll go find a better worship experience.
Isn't that a curse?
And Christian programming entertainment business,
yeah.
and I'm wondering, where's God in all this?
Yeah.
And so through meds, 12-step recovery, right. a sponsor, reading your stuff, your articles with the 4 A's, other people's stuff has just changed my life, and I'm trying to help get this in the church.
Yeah.
So I'm so thankful you're here, but there's...
What more can we do?
What more can we do?
Yeah. So, good question. Thank you very much. There are several things that I think are essential. The first one is people have got to be better informed about what's going on. I mean, education. We've got to educate. Ignorance is Satan's greatest weapon, and that has to be has to be fostered. The important principles. I outline 7 major principles in my book in terms of recovery. One has to exercise a certain discipline in turning off that stimulating music, video, whatever. We have to build into our lives a stronger appreciation for the importance of rest and sleep. Let me say this. My book I'm writing now is a book on sleep, but I would be so far as to say this, that if I could persuade everybody here today to get adequate quality sleep every day, nothing else you do the rest of the day would make any difference whatsoever. It's another way of my saying, and this is sort of a segue into my comment about stress. We have a stress problem for 2 reasons. One, the accelerated pace of life. And part of the accelerated pace of life is this increased level of stimulation that we all have now. It's the accelerated pace. We're moving too fast. We're trying to fit in too much in a small amount of time. But the second major factor that contributes to stress is the lack of recovery time. Stress is not the problem. The problem is that we don't give enough time to recover from our stress. I don't care how high your stress mountain is. Just make sure you've got a nice deep valley that follows it. And this brings me back to what I call the Sabbath principle. Now, I know that most evangelicals, we don't have a legalistic view. I have a lot of friends who in denominations that do have much more of a stronger feeling about the importance of Sabbath, but most evangelicals have a very loose idea. We do so to our detriment. Yes, Christ our Sabbath rest hath come, and so we claim as evangelicals that takes care of the obligation that was under the old covenant. And that's right. That's my theology. I believe that. But I don't think that theology is intended to mean that you can go ahead and abuse your body. Back to my point. You've got to live inside the box. And living inside the box means getting enough rest, getting enough sleep. And I honestly believe that if you get enough rest and sleep, I don't care. You can have that thing going all day, screaming out to you. I don't think it's not going to be that damaging, because we build into our life enough rest. And it's this rest time where this system, the dopamine system, needs to recover. We are running short on. So So there's a good starting point right there. Minimum sleep need for a healthy adult. Write it down. 9 hours a night. Minimum. No arguments. I could keep going down that road, but the point I want to make is that our stress problem today is a lack of recovery time. No Sabbath. And I think that every hour needs to have 5 minutes of Sabbath. I think every day needs to have a few hours of Sabbath. Maybe the nighttime is on Sabbath. Every week needs to have downtime. Pastors are the biggest culprits of all because you work when everyone else is doing their worship stuff. So you've got to take that time off. It's got to be quality time off. Don't work. Throw your cell phone away. Cell phones are satanic devices. And emails. I've got a long list of other satanic devices. I have a cell phone. In case you hadn't noticed, only one person knows the number. This is my wife. It's for emergencies only. It's when she's lonely. Well, honey, I just wanted to call and tell you I loved you. Miss you. Drive carefully when you come home. That's what this is for. Not another soul knows that number. Nor will they ever. But I counseled with a pastor recently. We've been huge, a big church, a lot of terrible, you know, changes and sacking of people, and he was totally burnt out. He came to see me. What can I do? I said, you're going to take a 6-month Sabbath. That's what we mean by sabbatical. No communication with the church. Don't go near that place. Find something else to do, you know. And it's this lack of rest, recovery, that is to a large extent our problem. If my grandchildren, if I could just get them to sleep minimum 9 hours a night. They, in fact, teenagers need 9.5 to 10 hours minimum. If I could only get them to sleep that, I wouldn't bother one bit about what they did with the rest of the day, because I know how this wonderful frame of mine is built. I know how the brain functions. I know my brain, neurology and physiology, I know all that stuff. I know what sleep does and why it's important. I know why dream sleep is important. It's not just ordinary sleep, it's dream sleep that's important. Every night of sleep, there should be an hour or two of just quiet reflection during a light stage of sleep. Because during that light stage of sleep is when your brain is doing all the processing, making the connections. All right, so much for that. Another comment or question? Thanks.
I wanted to know how hedonia affects other emotions, such as sadness, the ability to love.
Sure.
And will it lead to, if it does negatively affect those emotions, will it start leading to more psychopathic behavior in youth?
Very good question. Thank you. Yes, anhedonia can lead to a whole bunch of other things. One, there was a time when we thought you got depressed and then you developed anhedonia. Now we're reversing it. You develop anhedonia and then you become depressed. It's just a reversal of the order. In an anhedonic state, there are several pathologies that can follow. Your anxiety level can go up. So you can develop a whole bunch of anxiety disorders. Your apathy goes up. That can lead to a whole bunch of physical disorders. We are seeing a reduced immune system functioning in people with high levels of anhedonia. This means you get sick more easily. You develop more serious sicknesses. There's been quite a dramatic increase in viral-induced disorders, such as shingles. I have a couple of friends who recently developed shingles, very serious now, because their immune systems are so compromised. Our immune systems are no longer capable of providing us with the protection that they could provide 20 or 30 years ago. And the last one that would be worthy of mentioning here that anhedonia has is that the interesting thing is that when you are anhedonic and you're not getting pleasure, your adrenal system actually kicks in and tries to create stimulating compensation. So what happens is the pleasure system is not working properly, so the adrenal system tries to compensate for that. Your adrenaline level goes higher. It is such a problem now that there's evidence that most of us are actually enlarging our adrenal glands. The body is designed to adapt. And so if you're not getting pleasure from the pleasure system, then the adrenal system tries to compensate to give you a stimulating fix. But when adrenaline goes up, your risk of heart disease goes up, first of all. And when adrenaline goes up, its cousin goes up, named cortisol. And that's the other hormone you should note for future reference, because you're going to be hearing a lot about cortisol. When cortisol goes up, adrenaline cannot get into the brain. It's blocked. But cortisol can enter the brain. And cortisol, this other hormone from the stress system, goes to the brain and blocks three very significant receptors. The first receptor it blocks is the tranquilizing receptor. Cortisol blocks that receptor, the brain stops making its natural tranquilizer, so what happens is that anxiety level goes up. It's a biological form of anxiety. It can become panic anxiety eventually. In women today, the most common mental disorder, panic anxiety attacks. But I am seeing it now, epidemic in men. Strikes between age 35 and 40. It's cortisol, that's the problem. The second receptor it blocks is the sedation receptor. So cortisol prevents the brain from shutting down, relaxing, and getting enough sleep. And so even if you think you're sleeping, the brain isn't getting the rest it needs because the sedation receptor. And of course, add to that caffeine, and you've got a real bad mix. Modern day opium den, Starbucks. The third receptor is the anticonvulsant receptor. And so what also happens with cortisol is if you have any sort of brain disorder, it becomes worse. It just makes it worse. So anhedonia can have... lastly, I should mention that in young people, anhedonia reduces their capacity to learn. And I believe, and there's a growing body of evidence, and Rick's daughter talked to me during the break, so I was reminded of this, that the incidence of attention deficit disorder, you know what that is now, ADD, ADHD, one of the reasons we are seeing an epidemic in ADD is because we have an epidemic in anhedonia. So if you don't get pleasure in anything, that system... if you're constantly stimulated, what's causing anhedonia is this excessive stimulation, and that means that kids cannot focus down, attend, and they get diagnosed as ADD. I'm ready for one last question, and then I need to start packing. Or make it two. Was there someone? No. And then I need to go and get ready to go and teach this afternoon. You're much more fun to teach, I say, than those students.
I think I probably speak for most pastors here. We love this stimulation about the brain and knowing all this knowledge and all this stuff, and then we have to think about how we're going to go home and explain all this to our congregations about how the brain works, which we're going to lose them because they don't understand, don't have that attention mm-hmm. there. But here, my question to you is and I'm going to put you on the spot in the sense of that, would you describe to us, in your opinion, if you were to design a ministry, a church ministry, to speak to these kinds of issues, what would it look like in your mind? You get the dream. You get to do the imagination. Yeah. We get to see what you're thinking.
Yeah. Good question, because I've actually done that through a friend in South Africa. Zalah is a pastor of a large church there. It's a Dutch Reformed church, Afrikaans speaking. But he came and took my Doctor of Ministry course 3 times now. He's taken it, and he's taken back every one of my principles and has designed a whole campus and ministry around this issue. His campus, it's called Mosaic in a part of Johannesburg called Randburg. But there are several things that he did. Their music program, for example, their music directors all understand about anhedonia and the effects of stimulation. So their music is designed. Sure, a call to worship, get people, wake them up, get them ready. But their worship then moves into lower, more calm, peaceful, so that all worship has a sort of cyclic effect. So the worship design, very carefully tailored. Second thing he has done is that he has, they've got this huge auditorium type church in a circular fashion. So half the circle is the big auditorium. And the other half on the opposite side is a small chapel. Seats only 100 people. Every day from 12 noon to 2 o'clock, that chapel is open. A member of staff is there. And no word spoken, no music provided. But the church members are encouraged to go to that chapel on a regular basis and spend half an hour or an hour in quiet meditation. So he has a facility that fosters a meditational, contemplative, quiet time for people. So that's modeled. He also has a full-time physician and a full-time psychologist on staff in offices on the premises. They have a gymnasium where instead of signing up in the community for commercial-type exercises, programs and so on, it's all done as part of the community. Everything revolves around this circle design with and it's like a European city or town where there's a plaza in the center, a fountain, and around it all the activities are taking place. And that's exactly what he's done with this wonderful campus. I'll be preaching there in a couple of months. In other words, that the whole church program is designed towards building in wholeness, whether it's emotional, whether it's physical, whether it's spiritual, where worship is a balanced, nothing, you know, people need a wake-up call. People need to be stimulated. But at the same time, modeling for them the low experience. Now, I doubt if a single member of the congregation understands the phenomenon of anhedonia. But the pastor does. And he understands the needs of his people. And provides as a part of the church campus both physical and mental health resources to help people resolve those. That's a short description. But I still think that when I wrote my book, Adrenaline and Stress, 25 years ago, the publisher said to me, no one is going to know what that is about. Today, everybody knows what adrenaline is about. And I think it's just a matter of time, and everyone is going to know what anhedonia is about, because every one of your kids are going to be suffering from it. If not, you yourself. Well, thank you for the opportunity to share this with you, and I just trust that your ministry will be blessed and be more effective with the little bit that I've been able to contribute. So thank you, sir. Thank you, Rick.